All right, we are discussing the final week of Christ, and like I said yesterday, I'm going to have to pick up the pace just a little bit. So hopefully I can do that today. We'll see. Yesterday, as we were finishing up, we had been talking about some events that I feel happened on around Tuesday. We had the lesson of the fig tree. We had a confrontation with him about his authority. We had some parables. Did we do these? Yep. Good. You know, you have those moments when you think you talked about something and then all of a sudden you can't remember if you imagined talking about it in your head or if you actually did it. We talked about his fate being sealed about that time. The Jews finally, that was it. They'd had enough. And a question of taxes. He's going to get another question now about the resurrection. We're going to look at Mark chapter 12 for this one. Mark chapter 12, starting with verse 18. Then some Sadducees who say there is no resurrection came to him and asked him, saying, Teacher, Moses wrote to us that if a man's brother dies and leaves his wife behind and leaves no children, his brother should take his wife and raise up offspring for his brother. Now there were seven brothers. The first took a wife, and dying he left no offspring. The second took her, and he died, nor did he leave any offspring, and the third likewise. So the seven had her, and left no offspring. Last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, when they arise, whose wife will she be? For all seven had her as a wife. Now this is an interesting thing. How many of you have ever been asked a question that seems completely irrelevant to anything important? Like, how many angels can fit on the head of a pin? Or can God create a rock so big he can't move it? If you understand what the Bible is about and what Jesus is about and what creation is about and what the power of God is about, those questions have no bearing on anything. They're just meant to confuse. They're meant to distract. They're meant to trap. That's the only purpose for those kinds of questions, really. And that's what's happening here. It's interesting because the question is about marriage, but notice the emphasis on they had no sons. See, it's this idea of I'm going to ask a question, I'm going to try to distract him from the real point of the question, then bring him to the point of the question, and he won't know how to answer it. That's not going to happen. Jesus figured this out real quick. Jesus answered them, verse 24, Are you not therefore mistaken, because you do not know the Scriptures nor the power of God? That was the base problem of all of these men, right? All of the Jewish leaders. This was the issue right there. It wasn't the rules, it wasn't the regulations, it wasn't the questions, it wasn't the differences of opinion. It was that they didn't understand the point, even, of the old law. They missed it. So verse 25, For when they rise from the dead, they shall neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like the angels in heaven. But concerning the dead, they that rise, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the burning bush passage, how God spoke to him, saying, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. Therefore you are greatly mistaken. He brings them to a point that is much more important, not what's going to happen in the resurrection, what are we going to be like in the resurrection, what are we going to do after we're resurrected. That is not the important question. The important question is, God is not the God of the dead, He's the God of the living, therefore there will be a resurrection. That's what Jesus was trying to get him to understand from this point. Remember who he's talking to. He's talking to the group of Jewish leaders that argued vehemently that there was no resurrection, period. So he's trying to help them understand some things that they're not catching on to. And the very next point, the greatest command, comes as a result of this discussion. Because in verse 28, then one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, perceiving that he had answered them well, and Luke reiterates this, that they believed he had answered them well. This was a good answer to the question in some of them's eyes. He asked them, which is the first commandment of all? Now, Jesus has all of the law. He not only, in their eyes, has all of the law, he has all of the traditions and the regulations and all the fences around the law, as was talked about before. He's got all of these options, and he chooses this. The first of all the commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. This is the first commandment. This is something that they had. It's called the Shema. They had it in scrolls. They kept it. One of the things they would keep on their person a lot of times. They had it on boxes outside their house that they would touch when they went in and out of the house. This was one of the first things a Jewish child learned to say. Mama, Dada, hungry, and this. From the day they could talk, they were being lectured on this topic right here. And Jesus says, that is the most important thing. And he's already told them, you've misunderstood the whole point of the law. And now they've got this. And the second, he's not asked about this, he's unprompted, he offers, and the second like it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There's no other greater commandment than these. In one of the other accounts, he says all the law and the prophets hang on these two things. You know, it was mentioned by John, if we could change a person's worldview, that's a huge step, and that's what Jesus is doing right here. He's trying to change their perspective on everything. It's not about how far you walk on the Sabbath. It's not about whether you tithe your mint and your spices. It's not about all the intricate rules and regulations. It's about loving God, and it's about loving your neighbor. And everything else hangs on those. If we love God with all our heart, mind, soul, strength, we are going to do everything we can to be pleasing to Him. If you love me, you'll obey my commandments. If I love my neighbor as myself, the rest of all the Ten Commandments, the thou shalt nots, I'm not going to kill, I'm not going to murder, I'm not going to steal, I'm not going to envy, because I'm going to love my neighbor more than me. It's all hangs on those. So, verse 32, the scribe said to him, Well said, teacher, you have spoken the truth, for there is one God, and there is no other but He. And to love Him with all the heart, and all the understanding, and all the soul, and all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself, is more than the whole burnt burnt offerings and sacrifices. He gets it. It's like the light bulb comes on for this one. I don't know about the rest of them standing there, but this one seems to catch on. Now when Jesus saw that he answered wisely, he said to him, You are not far from the kingdom of God. You are so close, he says. And it's not because he's standing right next there to Jesus. It's because of his whole viewpoint on everything has changed. Maybe Jesus made a convert right there. I don't know what happens to this man. We don't know his name. We don't know anything about him, but I like to think that he stuck with it, that he figured these things out even further. Okay. Notice also, it says at the end of that passage, it mentions it again a couple of other places, but after that no one dared question him. Unless I've missed something, I don't think he gets any more questions until he's standing before the trials, at the different trials that he goes to, and the Sanhedrin or the chief priests or Pilate or somebody is asking him questions. Out in public, they stop trying. They can't get him. I don't know if he thought of that and that's what prompted this, but Jesus immediately brings up another point. And it's kind of an interesting point to bring up right here. Then Jesus answered and said, we're still in Matthew. I got to go to Matthew. So you get going back and forth, you forget where you're at. Matthew 22 is where we're going to pick up this one. Matthew 22, verse 41. While the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them, saying, What do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he? They said to him, The son of David. Now this is something they all would have agreed on. They knew this. There wasn't a lot of debate here. Verse 43, He said to them, How then does David in the Spirit call him Lord? Saying, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. If David then calls him Lord, how is he his son? That's a tough question for them to answer. Because they believed so much, as was brought out earlier, in the genealogies. These were very important to them. After learning the Shema, you started memorizing your genealogy back to Abraham. That was another thing you learned real early. Because every Jew, male Jew, had to be able to do this. And so it was assumed that somewhere in the physical lineage would be the Messiah. Now, did that happen? Was Jesus in the physical lineage of David? Absolutely. That's proven in two different places to us, beyond being just said over and over and over. So he was of the physical lineage of David, but he was greater than David. And normally the son is lesser than the father. David was considered the penultimate. When you talked about a king in Judea, a king of Israel, David was number one. Not first in number, because Saul preceded him there, but first in importance. He was looked to as a role model of what to be as a leader and as a good Jew. And even, you know, sometimes we do this too, right? Historical people that are important or viewed as important, pretty soon the stories of their mistakes kind of get washed away. Have you noticed that? All of a sudden they're a lot greater people than you think they were. How many stories do you hear about Abraham Lincoln or George Washington that cause you to think, wow, they weren't a very nice person at all? Those stories get lost to time. That may very well be one of the reasons that God has recorded several of the mistakes that David made, his bigger ones. I'm sure he made other ones. But his biggest ones are recorded for us to see. So, how can he call him Lord? Again, it says no one was able to answer him. They didn't even try. They didn't even try. Alright. Now Jesus goes into quite a long diatribe. We're going to stay in the book of Matthew for this, starting with chapter 23, starting with verse 1. Then Jesus spoke to the multitudes and his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do. I don't know if Jesus paused at that point, but it would have been interesting if he would, because that sounds like a compliment. Oh, now he's going to show our authority? But he doesn't. But do not do according to their works, for they say and do not do. For they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. But all their works they do to be seen by men. They make their phylacteries broad and enlarge the borders of their garments. They love the best places at the feasts, the best seats in the synagogues, greetings in the marketplaces, and to be called by men, Rabbi, Rabbi. But you do not be called Rabbi, for one is your teacher, the Christ, and you are all brethren. And do not call anyone on earth Father, for one is your Father, he who is in heaven. And do not be called teachers, for one is your teacher, the Christ. But he who is greatest among you shall be your servant, and whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Remember, he is saying this in a public arena with all these scribes and Pharisees, and they're standing right there listening, as well as your average Jew. Just your normal guy walking around the temple area, seeing what was going on with Passover arrangements. They're all there. So in one, and he's going to go on here, of course, but I just want you to think about this a little bit. In one phrase, in one speech, he is taking this group of people and pointing out all of the major flaws in their leadership and where they've brought the Jews as a nation to this date. And he's helping the rest of the people understand you don't have to listen to these people anymore. This is going away. And you're not going to be responsible to them. This is a celebration on one hand and hatred on the other is what's coming. Verse 13. But woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. He minces no words, does he? He just gets right to the point. For you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses, and for pretense make long prayers. Therefore you will receive greater condemnation. Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he is won, you make him twice the son of hell as yourselves. Woe to you blind guides who say, whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gift that is on it, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Therefore he who swears by the altar swears by it and by all things on it. He who swears by the temple swears by it and him who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and him who sits on it. Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. Blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you cleanse the outside of the dish, of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of extortion and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first cleanse the inside of the cup and dish, that the outside of them may be clean also. Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead man's bones and all uncleanliness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Therefore you are witnesses against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your father's guilt. Serpents, brood of vipers, how can you escape the condemnation of hell? Therefore, indeed, I send you prophets. Notice that, I? I send you prophets, wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that on you may come all the righteous bloodshed on the earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Assuredly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather you to your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Man, what a condemnation. Just over and over and over. It's like rapid fire against these people. One thing after another, after another, after another, without letting up, and they don't answer anything. They're afraid to. Every time, in the very recent, while they were standing there, every time they ask him a question, he put them in their place. They ask him another question, he put them in their place. They ask him another question, and he convicted one of the scribes of the truth. And now they're afraid to say anything. And remember, when he had just recently given those prophecies or given those analogies to them about the marriage feast and about the vineyard owner, I sent you and you killed them. I was here and you weren't ready. They knew he was talking about them. And so here he is again. Don't say you wouldn't have done what your forefathers did, because you're doing it right now. That's what he's saying. And you're going to do it in the future. We can see it in the life of Paul that we're looking at. It's just amazing. They're, over and over, he's condemning them. While he's there... while he's there. Mark chapter 12. Verse 41. Now, if it wasn't enough that he's just lambasting these leaders and calling them out, now he does this. Verse 41. Now, Jesus sat opposite the treasury and saw how the people put money into the treasury, and how many who were rich put in much. Then one poor widow came and threw in two mites, which make a quadrants. So he called his disciples to himself and said, "Assuredly, I say to you that this poor widow has put in more than all those who have given to the treasury. For they have put in and out of their abundance, but she out of her poverty put in all she had, her whole livelihood." While he's doing all this ranting on the scribes and the Pharisees and the leaders of the Jews, he is also watching what's going on. He's not so into his speech that he's missing the activities that are going on at the temple, and he wants to make sure his disciples are not missing something very important, this lesson. This lesson about how much are you willing to give up. If a person has $1,000 in their pocket, and they see somebody on the side of the road that needs some food, and they give them $100, they've given them a lot of money, but it didn't hurt them that much, right? Percentage-wise, it's not that big of a deal. But if somebody has a $10 bill, and they see somebody on the side of the road hungry, and they hand over that $10 bill, it's not as much money, but it's a greater sacrifice. And that's what Jesus is trying to help his disciples to see. Yes, these men are wealthy, they're powerful, and they claim they've given up a lot to follow the teachings of God, but they've given up nothing in comparison to what some of you are going to give up and what he is going to give up in a few days. He has nothing physically. He doesn't have a house. He doesn't have possessions. All he has is himself. And he's going to give it all up in just a short time. Then he goes into a series of lessons on the destruction of Jerusalem, the judgment day, a whole lot of different things. Keep my timing going. We'll go back to Matthew 24 and verse 1, because this helps us see where this is taking place. Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. Remember, Luke had pointed out that he would come in to Jerusalem in the mornings and be at the temple, and then he would leave in the evenings and go to the Mount of Olives for a time, and then based on what we can see, he would eventually go to Bethany in the evenings to sleep. So his time for the daytime is up in the temple, and he's now leaving. And I think that's important. These lessons are not given in the temple with all the scribes and Pharisees, with all the leaders of the Jews hanging around trying to hear what he's saying. This is outside of the temple area, possibly outside of Jerusalem, either on the way or at the Mount of Olives. And probably on the way, but we don't really need to debate that too much. So let's go to Luke. Luke chapter 21. Five and six. Then as some spoke of the temple, again, we've looked at the fact this is on the way out. As some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations. I just wonder about this. Because he's just decried the Pharisees and the Sadducees for their hypocrisy, for their false teachings, for for all the things they've done, and they're the ones that have adorned the tabernacle, the temple, like this. They're the ones that have added on, they've made it more beautiful, they've added more ceremonial places, they've just gone above and beyond what God had asked for. And now, as he's walking away, his disciples are commenting on how wonderful the temple looks today. It's all shined up for the coming Passover. It's all beautiful. Look at the work they've done on it. I have to wonder if Jesus thought maybe they had missed some of the things he'd just been talking about. So as they're saying this in verse 6, "These things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone will be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." He points out that that temple is going to be destroyed. Now, he has already talked to the, mentioned the fact that if you destroy this temple in 3 days, I'll raise it up again. And they thought he was talking about the temple, the physical temple that they worshipped at, but he wasn't. God points out to us that he was talking about himself, his own body. But now he's literally talking about the temple. These stones that you see, not going to be there anymore. We're going to jump back to Matthew again. Matthew chapter 24. Because verse 3 tells us that now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, his disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" And he's going to begin telling them some things. Like he's going to talk about some tribulation that is going to go on, starting with verse 4. "And Jesus answered and said to them, 'Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel, the prophet, standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been seen since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There,' do not believe it. For false Christs and prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, 'Look, he is in the desert,' do not go out. Or, 'Look, he is in the inner rooms,' do not believe it." Jesus here quotes a little bit, or at least alludes to, the book of Daniel. That abomination of desolation, we're not going to look into it too closely. Really not at all. But it's found in, that's quoted from, or taken from Daniel 11:31 and Daniel 12:11, where Daniel speaks that there's going to be an abomination that's going to happen, and that's going to be one of the signs. And Jesus says, that's coming. This is good for the apostles to hear, so that they can know that the desolation, the destruction of Jerusalem, is upon them. It's not going to happen in the too far future. But then he kind of switches gears in verse 27. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds in heaven of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. And so Jesus moves from a discussion of the destruction of Jerusalem into descriptions and anticipation of his second coming. And now he's got a couple of parables he wants to tell them, lessons. He wants them to make sure he gets. Now remember, he's just talking to his small group of disciples here. Starting with verse 32, we have the fig tree. Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near at the door. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. This is going to happen, he says. Just as sure as you can see from the fig tree a sign that there's going to be figs soon, you're going to be able to see that the Son of Man is coming back. He then goes into an analogy with Noah in verse 36. But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding in the mill, one taken and the other left. Watch therefore, you do not know what hour the Lord, your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming in an hour you do not expect. Just like the people were standing outside the ark wondering what in the world Noah was doing, building this thing, getting inside, where did all these animals come from? They're standing there wondering, and then whoosh, here comes the rain, and they're gone. That's just like it's going to be. Life is just going to be going on as if nothing else new or different was going to happen. And then one moment, that's going to be it. That will be the line. I wanted to make a quick comment about this idea in verse 40 and 41 of two people being there, one taken, one left. It's led to a lot of misunderstanding and false teaching. So I want to point out that that word left, it doesn't mean necessarily what we would assume it would mean. It doesn't mean, and I'll use the phrase because that's where it's at right now, it doesn't mean left behind the way it's used often. That word is, and if I pronounce this wrong, I'm sorry, A-P-H-I-E-M, A-F-A-Y-A-M, I think. It's in your Strong's Greek 863. It means sent away, omitted, going away from, or left out would be a better translation. Left out, not included. So one will be included and taken, and the other will be left out of my coming, of my second coming. They won't be part of where I'm taking the other one. That's the point Jesus is really trying to get across. Then he gives the example of two servants. Verse 45. Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom this master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat his fellow servants and eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him and at an hour when he is not aware of, and he will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Jesus says, you've got to be ready. Don't assume I'm not coming back. And he even says, if you take this course, if you decide you're going to be the big man on campus and try to take over and rule over your brethren, instead of letting me, Christ, be Lord of you and your brethren, he points out, I'm going to appoint your portion, your place, with the hypocrites. They just heard a long speech where Jesus called the Pharisees and the scribes and the chief priests and the Sadducees, called them over and over and over again, hypocrites. He's putting it back in their mind. If you do those things, you are no better than they are. And you know I don't like them. You know I'm not happy with the things they're doing. This is the point at which we're going to fly for just a minute. He then gives the parable of the 10 virgins. Hopefully we know that one. He gives the parable of the talents. He gives the parable of the sheep and goats. At my coming, I'm going to separate the sheep from the goats. Based on what? What was he going to base that separation on? You remember? Their works. The things they did. The things they did. Whether they actually did things, whether they helped the poor and the needy and the homeless and the hungry, whether they did that or whether they didn't, that's what he's going to judge them on. That should be a good lesson for us. Our judgment is going to be based on not just our faith and our belief, but also what we do with that faith and belief. His main goal in all of these parables is he's telling them, please keep watch. Don't be caught flat-footed. Don't find yourself thinking, well, he hasn't come for so long, I just don't think he's going to come. He's going to come. And we're in that position today. We have to be careful that we're not caught flat-footed. Now we are on Wednesday. Matthew 26, 1 through 5. We have a little bit of a time stamp. Jesus tells his disciples, you know that after 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified. We have a nice time stamp right there. It's kind of hard sometimes to put it on an exact day of the week. We're going to maybe talk about that in just a second. But he does put a time stamp on there, and in verses 3 and 4, we find that the chief priests and scribes, they're hanging out at Caiaphas' house. They're having this huddle. They're not at the Sanhedrin council. They're not in the synagogue. They're not at the temple. They're in the chief priest's house. This is a clandestine meeting where they are planning, trying to figure out how by trickery that they can catch Jesus off guard. So Jesus reminds his followers of his death, and the Jews solidify their plans. And then we have this account of Mary anointing Christ. We're going to look at it's so hard to decide where to go. Well, Matthew 26:6. Jesus is in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper. There's a fragrant oil brought. We just have to bounce back and forth. There's no way to hurry. John chapter 12, verse 2 and 3, we find out from John that this is Mary that does this. Probably, I think, Mary Magdalene. You know, you disagree. Okay. So Mary anoints Jesus. She puts it on his hair, puts it on his feet. And one of his disciples in verse 4, Judas Iscariot, we would expect none other. Judas Iscariot says, we should have sold this. For what purpose? To give to the poor? That's what he says. But his purpose is to put it into the treasury so that he can grab some out later. We know that part. Mark. Let's look at Mark's account of this. Mark chapter 14. And being in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, he sat at the table, and a woman comes. Again, could have sold it. I'm not finding the place I wanted to find. Matthew 50. This is what happens when you try to hurry. There it is. John chapter 12. Sorry. John chapter 12. We find out that Martha served. Lazarus was one of those who sat at the table with him. Mary took a pound of very costly oil. Again, I got ahead of myself in my notes. I think I may have just said that this was Mary Magdalene. Not Mary Magdalene. I think this is Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus, that does this. Is that why you shook your head no?
I believe there's two different times
that this happens.
The house of Simon the woman is a prostitute.
Okay.
Different marriage.
Okay. He's saying that he thinks it's two different times at the house of Simon. It's a prostitute. A different Mary is here. Okay, so right, not Magdalene, not the sister. Yep. Here is the next thing that happens is actually away from Jesus, but we have an account of it. Luke chapter 22. Luke chapter 22, verse 3. Then Satan entered Judas, surnamed Iscariot, who was numbered among the 12. So he went his way and conferred with the chief priests and captains how he might betray him to them there. And we won't turn there, but in Matthew's account of this, we're told that Judas basically goes to them and says, I'm willing to do this. What are you willing to pay me? And they count out for him the money, the 40 pieces of silver, and then they agree to the price. And notice in Luke's account in verse 6, so he promised and sought opportunity to betray him to them in the absence of the multitude. I don't know if this is shame or propriety or something. Remember, the chief priests did not want to try to take him in public around the multitudes. They were afraid of that. So I don't know which of those things prompted Judas, but he is very concerned with being able to do this somewhere away. Somewhere away from the crowds. Well, Luke's already told us Jesus has a routine this week. He comes to Jerusalem in the morning. He goes back to Bethany in the evening by way of the Mount of Olives. And he does this day after day after day. So, where is the most logical place for Judas to accomplish this task? On the Mount of Olives. That's the place where he is in between crowds and on his way. On his way. I want to address something, and this may run me just a little bit over. I hope not too far. Because I did have a question that was asked of me, and I knew we were going to have to discuss this at some point. And the person that asked it is not going to be able to be here the rest of the week, so I wanted to make sure that we got this addressed. There are lots of different timelines, if you wanted to look them all up, for what day what happened during this week. And I thought I would just take a second to kind of review the four that I think are the most common, that I came across the most often. The first one is the traditional view, and that's basically what you have with my own little tweaks. That's basically what you have in front of you. There are two views that have two different Passover suppers, that there was a Passover, and before the Passover, there was a supper that Jesus had with his disciples. One of those is based on the Qumran Jubilees calendar. The basic Jewish calendar was based on the lunar month. All right, the first day of the month was at the new moon. The Qumran Jubilees calendar went on a solar calendar. It's based on a certain number of days in the year. So as a result, the days of the Qumran calendar and the days of the traditional Jewish calendar get off once in a while by one day or two or three, depending on the month. So there's one belief that this is what happened. The people that put this idea forth, one of the main differences is that the trials start Tuesday night, and the trials go from Tuesday night, I got to do it this way for your Tuesday night all the way through Wednesday into Thursday, or through Thursday and into Friday morning. The other two Passover idea is that Jesus ate the Passover with his disciples but ate it early so that he was freed up to have the things happen that needed to be happening around Passover. Again, this one also has the trials going Thursday night into Friday morning, but has a special observance of the Passover. And the fourth most common that I found was that the idea that the Last Supper wasn't the Passover. It was just a common, ordinary meal. And you'll find these all over the place. You start looking on the internet, you start reading books, you do all kinds of things, and you're going to find all of these different ideas. Instead of arguing about which ones are right or wrong, what I want to do is I want to look at things based on the scriptures that we know to be true about the timeline, that we can really nail down and know for sure. And whatever timeline you decide to adopt to your own understanding, these things have to fit because they're there. We know for sure the Gospels clearly put the crucifixion the day after the supper. If you look at those, and we are going to, if you look at those passages very closely, there's no opportunity for there to be two or three days in between what we call the Last Supper and the crucifixion, the trial starting. It just can't be. It doesn't fit. We also know that the preparations were the same day the lambs were killed. Mark 14:12 and Luke 22:7 are very specific that Last Supper happened on the day that the Passover lambs were to be killed. We also know from the accounts that Jesus and his apostles both insist by their verbiage that this is the Passover. Go prepare the Passover. We'll read a lot of these things later. And I know this, that the witnesses, all the witnesses, right then and afterwards and in the scriptures following, they all believed and understood it to be 3 days. Whatever that meant. Now, the complication with the 3 days comes from one passage, Matthew chapter 12 and verse 40, when Jesus brings up the sign of Jonah, 3 days and three nights. We have to remember a couple of things. There are a lot of places, Matthew 27:63, the chief priests and Pharisees say that what Jesus said was after 3 days he would rise. That's what they tell Pilate. Mark 8:31, Jesus said, after 3 days I will rise again. Matthew 26:61, the false witnesses that are brought up say that Jesus said in three days he would raise. Matthew 27:40, at the cross, the the Jewish leaders at the cross that are mocking him say, "You said after 3 days you would rise." Mark 14:58. Jesus predicts it, and when he's predicting it, he says, "In 3 days." Every other time that this, and there, we could look at a lot more of them, but every single time this is brought up in any other passage, whether it's Jesus or somebody else quoting Jesus, it's in or after 3 days. Sometimes it's on the third day. When we get to Luke chapter 24, verse 21, and we see Jesus' appearance to the men on the road to Emmaus, when they're explaining things to this man that they don't recognize as Jesus, they say, "And since these things, this is the third day since these things have happened. And we were hoping that he was the Messiah." So this idea of 3 days is accepted by the apostles, it's accepted by all the New Testament writers, it's accepted by all the early church writers that we see, that we can go back and read. We don't know, I think, what the exact expression was meant by "as Jonah was in the belly of the fish, 3 days and three nights." That's the only time the three nights is brought up. So I think we need to be careful and not get hung up on timelines and accuracy of dates so much as to understand the point. That Jesus was in the tomb long enough to be dead. For everybody to recognize that he was dead and to fulfill the prophecy of 3 days. Now I hate to leave you hanging on that, but I'm going to just say, talk to me later, because there's several hands, and you know, we're just, one of the things I think we have to do is take on faith the fact that everybody understood it, and then, and in 3 days and on 3 days, there are 3 days. There are 3 days. The problem really is not, to me, the 3 days. The problem that we end up arguing about is the three nights. And that's not nearly as important, I think, based on what I was saying, with the in 3 days and on the third day and after 3 days. The days is what Jesus emphasized over and over and over and over. And we can get the 3 days very easily by Friday part of a day, Saturday, and Sunday part of a day. So, like I said, I hate to leave you with that, but I'm over time already, and Mark's got his remote out, and he's going to shut me up. So...